Welcome back to Crossing the Pond. This episode is an opportunity that I'm very excited about. I get to speak to somebody that I haven't spoken to properly for a long time, but I used to work with maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and has always been one of the perfect examples of those people that sit within a B2B brand and make things happen. And that involves managing upwards, managing the agencies, and really just ensuring that the brands that she's working for get more than their fair share of attention. And so I want to find out, how does Agnes Passafis use that and do that? And how does she achieve that? So Agnes, welcome to Crossing the Pond.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you too. Thank you very much for joining us today. Before we dive in, I was wondering if you would just take a minute to talk us through your career trajectory. How did you end up where you're at?
Well, it was a long journey getting here, but I was originally born and raised in Canada, and I started my career in the automotive industry, first working on the advertising agency side, and then eventually landed in a great position in Toronto as the marketing director for BMW. That took me on a long journey with BMW, where I held various positions dealing extensively with agencies because I managed everything from international advertising to international exhibitions, partner training and development. And I stayed in the automotive industry with BMW for almost 10 years and then moved into IT. And from there, things really took off because the IT sector was, of course, also growing very rapidly. And so I've been at a number of different great brands in information technology. I started with a company called Compaq that was acquired by HP. And since then, moved on to various wonderful companies, HP after the acquisition, and then Citrix. I have a lot of experience in cybersecurity as well. I also worked in data and analytics, and most recently for a company called Cloudera. And since this year in January, I've been working with Exclusive Networks, which is a cybersecurity company, really prominent globally, a really leading company in terms of helping cyber vendors develop their business around the globe.
Right. Interesting. So within the current role that you're in, what function does branding have in terms of your current responsibilities?
So branding definitely falls under my remit. I collaborate closely with corporate comms, which reports in our company to HR, as it does in many companies. So there's a close collaboration there. But I'm really just building global marketing in our company because we didn't really have a big global marketing function. We're a company that likes to call ourselves global. So we are very global in terms of our presence and have a very strong local presence with all of the offices that we have in more than 50 countries around the world, but we're really growing our company now. We were public and have now gone private and are really looking to increase the growth of the company over the next 5 years. And a big part of that and one of the big levers will be marketing. And of course, brand falls squarely under that. So I'm the VP of global marketing in the company, building a whole new way of doing marketing for the company. I'm very excited about that.
And so one of the things that I've seen you do, and one of the things I want to explore further, which you just touched upon, is the concept of being global, but also being able to act local. That global phrase, I think that you just
that
used.
That global phrase we use a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So that's particularly, it strikes me as being particularly important and challenging when you've got a product where everything from compliance and regulation to the markets you're selling into are presumably very different according to the region that you're talking to. And yet, brands need to be consistent. Well, first of all, how do you build the machine? But secondly, how do, from a brand strategy perspective, how do you allow that brand to be consistent and of quality on a global basis, but also nuanced on a local basis?
So you're right. It is challenging because when you want to maintain a strong local presence, which is fundamental to our business in terms of our business model and how we work, because we work with literally hundreds of vendors that are focused on cybersecurity. And what they really rely on from us is having a very strong local presence. But as they say, the sum is greater than the whole of its parts. And really, that starts with having a very strong brand presence, brand strategy, and ensuring that the strategy and the vision is very known in the company, and really working to cascade it into the various regions that we have, which are 6 in total globally, from those regions into the countries, and from those countries locally, to ensure that everyone in the company is really aligned on what the company is trying to do and understands their role in terms of how they represent brand locally so that we have a consistent presence. It's also something that's really very much desired by a lot of the alliance partners and or vendors that we deal with whose brands we represent. And a big part of what they're looking for is to ensure that we're protecting their brand presence as well, and that we're consistent in terms of how we represent and present them globally.
Which must be extremely challenging because everything's moving, nothing is static. And so all those partners that you're talking about will also have different manifestations of their brand that they need from time to time. The control freak in me listens to the role that you described with, I think you said 50 different offices globally. The control freak must be going crazy in that situation.
You know, it's not as hard as you think when you have solid cadences put into place. And that's what it's really about. When you have a process and a cadence and a strong strategy as a company, it's amazing how you can align with teams and get everyone singing from the same song sheet. We're really in the process now of establishing that because we didn't always have it as a company, but yeah, we're moving very strong in that direction. And we're getting a lot of support from our vendor alliances because they work very much that way as well. So oftentimes we're modeling the way they work or they're modeling the way we work and working to get a stronger global presence. There isn't a single company that works globally or does business globally, then isn't looking to always maintain that strong global consistency, because everybody knows that ultimately that leads to a stronger presence, a stronger brand, and ultimately growth.
And so that leads me on to my next question, which is measurement. One of the questions that I've been asking all the different guests that have come on to Crossing the Pond so far has been, how do they go about connecting the work that's been done in marketing to the revenue that's needed by the business? That can be quite a challenging connection to make. And I think since marketing was invented, there's been many different phrases that have been published about the complexity of that process. In all the different organizations that you've worked with, which have been some of the market leaders in their sector, and also some ambitious, fast growth businesses that you've mentioned, how do you go about measuring the impact of brand and marketing in a way that the board responds to?
Well, it is difficult. And in particular with brand, it's difficult because brand is not something that you can measure shorter term in order to equate it and or correlate it to business results on a quarterly basis, let's say, or even on an annual basis. Brand is something that you look at the impact of longer term. And there are certainly measures you can put into place to look at how you measure brand. But we are very active, and I have been in every company I've worked in providing marketing attribution and in measuring marketing attribution. It's an hours-long discussion because marketing attribution is something that also has evolved and continues to evolve because data analytics have evolved so much. The way we look at attribution is becoming extraordinarily sophisticated. And it has a lot of parameters because it's not just about the work that marketing is doing. It's predominantly about the work that marketing does as it correlates to sales. And yep, when you look across the whole value chain in terms of how you initiate interest in products, let's call it, and how you take that interest and you nurture it and how you convert it and turn it into sales opportunities, and then eventually turn that into an actual sale that can be linked back to the investment that you've made. That ROI, as we call it, or ROMI, return on marketing investment, is something that is a daily topic in our company and in every company that I've worked in, because it takes a lot of energy and education to really understand how those attribution models work, even for those of us who are in marketing. But what's particularly difficult is explaining it and simplifying it for others in organizations who have to be able to look at the data points and interpret them. And so we spend a lot of time having to educate people and having to interpret data for people so that they can understand why we're deciding to put investments where we are and how we can actually get the best return from those investments. But yes, the attribution side of marketing has become extraordinarily complex, but it is indeed what really drives decisions today. And it's all data driven.
And so, as you know, we're focused on earned media and content marketing, but predominantly on earned media at Champion Communications. PR has notoriously been a very difficult thing to measure. And the contribution that PR can make to the business development and growth is very obscure. You've been in so many different types of organizations. What would you say is best practice for measuring earned media as a metric in the ROMR model that you just described? RMI, sorry.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Earned media is extraordinarily valued because it's earned, it's not paid. So by nature, it has a higher value or valuation to it. but we all want to measure it and be able to measure it so that we can gauge predominantly vis-a-vis our competitors what our share of voice is. So it's predominantly in earned media, really about share of voice. It's about defining the landscape and looking at a regular cadence or in points of time, be it weekly, monthly, quarterly, annually, how the needle is moving in terms of getting that share of voice in the market, in conjunction with, you know, the various competitors that you have in that market. And so there are definitely ways of measuring it, but share of voice, I think, still remains for earned media the predominant measure.
I tend to agree with you. I think it's not perfect in terms of attribution, but it is a consistent benchmark that allows you to do gap analysis between your brand and your competitors to see what they're getting. I think it as an indicator, I think it's the best that is available at the moment in time.
I think it is as well, but I also think, if I may, that the trick, I think, with earned media is less about volume and more about message. And so often companies are tricked into believing if that they push volumes of content out into the market and get any kind of coverage on that content, that they're really influencing. And that's what's really difficult to measure, is how much influence it is having. We tend to believe that more thought leadership oriented content, and content that is really enabling a company to position itself or have a position on particular strategic topics that are influencing things like C-level leaders, even if you're not as frequently in the press, but when you are out doing something that's significant, I believe makes difference. So I think when you measure share of voice, it's really important not to measure it strictly on volume, but really to categorize it in some way. Yeah, I remember when we worked together, we very distinctly looked differently at product type things that we were doing and at thought leadership type things. And it's, so it's important to measure those things separately, I think.
I agree. I think the other thing that is obviously upon us at the moment is AI and the way in which AI is being used by B2B buyers to help them to find different brands and different suppliers. How have, or are you adapting the marketing playbook that you've worked with in the past? Are you changing that at all with the arrival of AI, or how has that been incorporated into your planning?
We are absolutely changing the model through AI. It is the single largest factor that's influencing how we do marketing. It's changing the speed at which we do marketing, and it's really changing everything along the entire value marketing chain. Everything from how we plan resources for marketing, how we make decisions around where we're going to implement those resources, when we execute them, how we measure their effectiveness in terms of what they're yielding from scoring models and everything, you know, that goes around scoring and testing and deciding whether a particular channel that you've chosen is actually yielding you what you predicted that it would yield. Predictive analytics in terms of doing targeting and identifying the right buyers or prospects. And in particular, looking at how you do ROI and then how you report ROI. And in our business, a big part of what we do, because we're working a lot with market development funds that are granted to us by our vendors, how we then measure that and claim it and the process and admin around that. So everything from start to finish along the entire chain is being influenced by AI. And we haven't even, you know, we haven't seen the tip of the iceberg, really. It's just it's just so much. But what I'm really seeing, the predominant area where I'm really seeing the influence is on content. So content and the speed at which you can produce content, things like digital assets, it's just exponential. It's exponential.
Yeah. And allows you to do things like A/B testing much more easily in terms of different designs, different formats, different messaging, which I think is incredibly empowering. Big changes that have happened in the industry, in the PR industry, since I've come into it. When I started, and I don't want to cast any aspersions on anybody else, but when I started, we had printed press releases, we had cover letters, we had envelopes, we had to staple everything together, post it all out to the press. We couldn't look online to see what the journalists had written. We had to look at the hard copies and do our research that way. And of course, the world has changed dramatically since then. So I think the advent of digital in terms of media has been a big shift. And I think that now we've got the advent of AI being another big shift. The thing that's been consistent throughout those two big moments is the need for engaging, interesting, consequential content, which you'd mentioned earned before, and how earned media is more credible, more valid, more trusted by the audiences. What do you think is coming next in terms of the way in which B2B buyers are interacting with brands?
Well, look, you know, what we know from B2B buyers today in our business is that 75% of the process that they go through on their journey with us is already taking place before we meet or see them face to face. So not only press, but content in general, whether it's on a website, whether it's in earned media, whether it's, you know, at some live event that they might go to, our own event, a third party event, they are 75% into making a decision before they even begin to engage with us. So there is a lot happening, and most of that is related to content. And what we see now is that the speed and the volume of that content and the way that it's hyper-targeted and our ability to hyper-target it and even hone in more on influencing that 75% of the decision-making journey before the engagement process takes place is what's changing exponentially, because we know that when you walk into a customer's office, physically walk into their office and actually have that privilege and ability to be able to sit down and have an in-person conversation, that is not the start of the relationship. The relationship has started long before that in an information gathering phase. And so that has really become a game changer.
Right.
And once the decision is made for a customer to actually purchase from us and get on the journey with us, what's also really changing is all the nurturing that needs to take place to ensure that you are engaging that customer, keeping them engaged, customer success, loyalty, which all leads to being able to ultimately upsell, expand, repurchase. Yep. And as we all know in marketing, the oldest rule, right? It costs a lot more to acquire a new customer than it does to keep an existing one happy and keep them moving up and buying more and more. So that whole journey, which, you know, I like to call it an infinity loop. A lot of people say that it's, you know, it's a cyclical journey, but it really isn't. It's almost more like an infinity loop that starts with information and acquiring information and then becoming more engaged with us. And then, you know, eventually being enabled by us during the process of purchase and then really optimizing that purchase process, and it goes round and round. So all of that is highly influenced by content. And in the end, you know, it's interesting because we used to say content is king. It still is. It's just that the way we process content and our ability to hyper content and use content in omni-channel marketing today has become so much more sophisticated, which means that ultimately things can become more personal. You know, many marketers believe there's no such thing as B2B anymore, that everything is really B2C, because although the businesses are defined as being B, everything is really C today, right? Because it's all very personal. Communication has become extraordinarily individual or personal.
Yeah. So you say it's B2C to B, really, is essentially the
yes.
The,
yes.
Yeah. And you're selling to individuals and human beings. Do you think that the world of marketing has got easier or more complicated?
It's definitely got more complicated. Definitely more complicated.
All these new technologies come, whether it's a database, a CRM system, all these different tools. But I think you're right. I think it has become more difficult for people in the B2B marketing role because there's so much more data. Do you think marketing has become more efficient, though, as a result? Because you mentioned hyper-focused targeting. And do you think that there's less wastage?
I think parts of it have become more efficient, but I think as we go through this transformation of what AI essentially is doing to impact marketing and what data and analytics in a broader sense are doing to impact marketing, the levels of sophistication at which we put ourselves in the position to make decisions sometimes complicates things more than it should. Because at the end of the day, that cycle I talked about, or that infinity loop I talked about, it's the one thing that always remains constant. Customers are going to consider you. They're going to go through a decision-making process. They're going to ultimately either decide or not decide for you. And they're ultimately going to decide if they stay with you or not. That will always be the same. What we've done, though, is put so much more analysis and depth into that process. Have we made life more complicated for ourselves than we maybe should have? Probably not, because the more we understand about the customer, the more we can become less generic about how we approach that customer, how we satisfy that customer. But is it more complex in terms of how we deliver on that operationally speaking? It absolutely is. But it enables us to scale much more effectively. And I would say that that's the biggest impact. You know, companies have always had great ideas and great strategies and ways of doing things, but being able to scale, and particularly when you're a global company, and being able to scale in a manner that it's quite personal with people has always been a challenge, and that becomes easier for sure.
Okay, interesting. The other thing that occurred to me when I was looking through the different company you've worked for, issues management has clearly been an important part of that process because you've had some very high visible brands, some of which have worked in very contentious areas, cybersecurity being one, for example, whereby we've seen a litany of breaches recently that have had impacts on share prices around the world. You've got the global perspective and you've got all these different regions doing their own thing. Issues management, obviously not talking about your current existing business because of course that would be confidential and sensitive, but just in terms of lessons that you might have in terms of crisis and issues management, is there anything you can share in terms of experiences you've picked up along the way?
Well, one thing will always remain the same. I was saying this to our marketing leadership team last week in a meeting that we had in Paris, which is that, you know, the old expression, teamwork makes the dream work. The more you have to manage as a team, the broader scale, geographically speaking, that you have. And so we're a global company. And I can talk absolutely about the company that I'm in because the same lessons apply. It's really about establishing, you know, it sounds kind of boring, but these things are fundamental. Establishing a solid way of working as a team that really has people aligned around the same vision, around the same goals, has common KPIs in place so that people are all being measured at a high level on similar KPIs, but contributing their part to that. Have people really understanding where do they fit in the puzzle of this big global, you know, project of marketing that we have. Vision, alignment, and teamwork will always remain, irrespective of the technologies and the tools that we use and the things that we're trying to do, will always remain the fundamentals of how to make things work effectively. When one of those gets off kilter, you see that things begin to fall apart. So I think that that's what's fundamental and will always be fundamental. And those are the lessons that I've seen and experienced and tried to teach my teams that have worked for me over and over, you know, that in one way we have become more complex, but we also have a role, and it's a fundamental part of the marketing role, is to simplify the complex. That's essentially, yeah, as marketers, what we do. We're here to simplify the complex for our customers, also for our internal stakeholders, and especially as marketing gets more and more complex, how do we simplify all of this? How do we make people understand that at the end of the day, it's really about creating differentiation? It always will be. That's what marketing is there to do. It's really about, you know, establishing a preference based on the information that you provide and based on the experience that you provide to prospective customers or existing customers. Those things will never change.
Yeah, interesting. So singularity of vision, collaboration, teamwork,
alignment.
And alignment, all being the kind of the four ingredients from Agnes's playbook. Particularly challenging in this post-pandemic world where people are working remotely and yes, there's less of a connection. Have you got any insight you can share into how to tackle that? Because I don't think that's become any easier, despite all the connectivity that we've got.
Well, it hasn't. It hasn't. I mean, you know, we were forced by virtue of COVID to become more online in terms of the way we worked with each other. And that has enabled us in so many ways. I have a weekly meeting with my marketing leadership team. I had it this morning with a person sitting in Singapore, a person sitting in Sydney. We have people sitting in Europe and in the US. And it's, you know, keeping people together in a team once a week, sharing, yeah, sharing their best practices, sharing their challenges. People always need a sense of belonging. That's why I think teamwork is so important. And it really enriches the experience at work when you belong to a team and where you have a stabilizing force, right? To be able to say, yeah, oh, you know, I'm going to meet with my team tomorrow. That's great. I need to ask everybody a question that's really perplexing me this week that, you know, I'm challenged with, or I can't wait to share the great success that I had this week in the event. You know, these are my people. They're going to appreciate what I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is hard enough when you're dealing with one country. But when you're dealing with a diverse geographic distribution of team, with different cultural preferences, different business etiquettes. I've seen you do that so well in so many different roles. What have you learned? What's your trick for cutting through all the differences that are needed in order to bring everybody together?
There are always going to be more things that unite us than divide us. It's human nature to sometimes look at the differences and make them prominent when in actual fact, our commonalities are really what unite us. And most often in business, irrespective of language and culture, particularly in business, first and foremost, what unites us is when we work in a single company, like we, you know, we do in my case, what unites us is the fact that we are all working to do one thing, which is promote that particular brand all day long and grow that business. What unites us is the company's vision. What unites us is the part that each of us play in forming the whole of that business. And so, you know, we must always try to focus on what is common. That doesn't mean you always go for the lowest common denominator. Quite to the contrary, when you look at the things that are the most important in business every day in terms of what we're trying to get across, which at the end of the day for marketers is really one thing. It's about storytelling. It will always be about storytelling. What today's technology enables us to do is tell that story in a myriad of ways, in very unique ways, but still be connected. That's what we're doing better than we've ever done. The biggest problem marketers used to have is, oh gosh, you know, we're doing this over here with the events, but it doesn't really relate to what we're doing over here in digital. Well, now omnichannel marketing and the thread that binds all those things has become so strong. And so our ability to tell that one consistent story. And is it important to tell it in the same way across different countries, albeit giving it a bit of a twist as you need for language purposes or cultural differences? It's absolutely doable. I've seen it done over and over again. And what I think it does is it unites people. It unites people around a common vision. When everybody's off trying to define the vision themselves and trying to redefine the brand in particular themselves, it never amounts to anything good over time. It's never a sustainable approach.
Yeah, fascinating. The story. It's always the story. I'd like to switch gears now, if I may, a little bit, and talk to you about the skill set that's required when it comes to managing lots of different agencies, because it's something that I've known you to do with great success. I don't think it's something that people are necessarily trained or taught in. And a lot of the people that I want to be tuning into Crossing the Pond will be people in your position who've got this responsibility for managing networks or managing multiple different agency configurations. Any tips on how to go about building that infrastructure?
Absolutely. You know, when I started at this particular company and I started meeting all our agencies, you know, it's human nature, right? A new global VP of marketing comes in and the agencies are thinking, gosh, you know, what's she going to do? Is she going to bring in her own agencies? Is she going to keep us? And, you know, I always sit down with the agencies and first of all, get to know them. And my first questions are never, what is it that you're delivering to us? And how are you proving that it's working? It's always, how's the relationship with our people? How good are they at briefing you? Because I believe that that is what's at the heart of a great relationship with an agency. You know, no matter how junior you are in a marketing team or how senior you are on a marketing team, when you're sitting across from a partner that you're expecting to provide a service to you, your number one obligation and your number one goal is to be an ambassador of your company and to be able to tell the story of your company and educate that service provider so that they can provide an excellent service to you. And for agencies, because they are driven by strategy and creativity, and that's what makes them tick all day long, you have to be able to inspire. Is that always easy for more junior marketers? Not always, but, you know, having a solid brief and really being able to guide an agency, to provide to you what it is you're looking for from them is always going to be at the heart of establishing a good relationship agency. It's the old garbage in, garbage out, right? We often, you know, expect our agencies to come up with incredible programs, ideas, projects, campaigns, whatever, without really having empowered them or informed them to the depths or in the way that they need to be able to do their job effectively. So I think that fundamental to agency relationships in particular is it's like a marriage, right? You have to really be able to give as much as you can from your side if you want to get back what you're expecting.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I do remember actually when we first started working together, you had that conversation with us. I hadn't remembered it until you just brought that up, but absolutely, I can testify that years ago, you were even doing the same thing. So that was, yeah, absolutely true. Very cool. And so in terms of the dilemma that I think many people in your position might face, which is the option of you've got a big brand, you've got presumably a budget that fits that, you've got a need to put in place a network or a PR infrastructure or an agency infrastructure. It doesn't have to be just PR. One of the obvious choices is to go for a big global network or to go for independent boutique agencies. Can you talk to me about how you view that decision and what are the factors that you take into account?
Well, you know, it's not that black and white because I've worked with both very effectively. And I think it very much depends on, you know, the company you're working for and what the best fit is for that company. Some companies are simply set up in terms of their infrastructure to be able to work more effectively or can only work effectively with other big global networks because they have alignment processes set up that require coverage, that require a certain level of sophistication is not really the word I'm looking for, but alignment process, really. Whereas other companies that I've worked for that were smaller really benefited much more from having a boutique-like approach. What I think ultimately, though, is that you need a healthy combination because when you're running, you know, things like AR and PR processes worldwide, I think, you know, you definitely need a strong core at the company that manage that process at the top of the company so that you're ensuring that your messaging and your strategy and the story that you're trying to tell as a company is very clear. And you clearly need, you know, very seasoned partners to work with you on defining what that is. How you then cascade that down and how you then ensure consistency across the globe can sometimes work effectively with a large network. Sometimes it works against you and you actually need really strong local partners to be able to take that and enhance it. I've seen both work effectively, but again, I think it's dependent on the size of the company, the culture of the company, the setup of the company, the skill set of the company, and then finding, it's almost like a recipe, the agency that really can fit and align into that. For example, if you're a really large multinational company and you're trying to work with a boutique agency, chances are that boutique agency is going to get frustrated with you, or maybe that boutique agency can work really well with you at the corporate level of the organization in defining strategy and doing some really creative things. But when you're relying on them from an infrastructure point of view to help you cascade things down and execute them globally, they might not have the wherewithal to be able to do that. So ultimately, I think it's usually a combination that works effectively.
Interesting. Fantastic. Agnes, that's been so interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your perspectives with us today. I really appreciate it very much. Thank you.
I appreciate always talking to you, Richard. It's always been a pleasure working with you and I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much.